You're right, of course, Alvino, Caleb said now. And we'll be watching for similar attempts, I assure you. I just pray we can protect ourselves against this kind of thing without turning into some kind of suppressive tyranny ourselves.
I'm afraid we're going to have to put at least some additional precautions in place, Your Majesty, Wave Thunder replied unhappily. They succeeded, in large part, because we weren't expecting it, and I think future attacks on the same scale are unlikely. I doubt they're going to be rolling around the city with wagon loads of gunpowder again, for example, especially with our new licensing and inspection systems in place. No system's perfect, though, and we obviously can't guarantee they don't have the men and materials in place to keep testing it for weak spots when we still don't even know how they got the gunpowder into the assassin's hands to begin with.
We still don't have any clues about that, my lord? One of the other councillors asked,
and Wave Thunder grimaced in disgust.
No, he admitted flatly. And I'm reasonably certain the one Rakurai we managed to capture doesn't know how they did that either. No one's going to torture any confessions out of him, but we haven't been especially gentle and understanding about questioning him.
He smiled thinly.
He's told us where he went to collect his explosives, but they were delivered to him by another of Clintan's agents, the one who detonated the Grey Wyvern Avenue bomb, unless I'm mistaken. He got the gunpowder from a source, a pickup point, here in Old Caris. But our prisoner doesn't know where that was. What we do know, unfortunately, from examining the wagon Merlin kept him from blowing up in Queen Freyla Avenue, is that the powder originally came from us.
What?
The other councillor demanded, sitting up sharply in his chair, and Wave Thunder grimaced.
40 pounds of it were still in its original kegs, he said, and they carried the markings of the Hayratha powder mill. I think we have to assume that's why the powder mill was blown up. My current theory is that Commander Mandrain, Baron Seamount's assistant at King's Harbour, noticed a discrepancy somewhere in one or more of the shipping manifests from Hayratha. Most of you may not know that Captain Sullivan, the commanding officer at Hayratha, was Commander Mandrain's cousin. It would have made a certain degree of sense for him to take any suspicion to his cousin in an effort to handle things as quietly as possible, and it seems likely that whoever was responsible somehow realized Commander Mandrain and Captain Sullivan had become aware he'd diverted powder from the mill. I don't know how that happened, how the commander and Captain Sullivan might have given away their suspicions, but if I'm right about what happened, he blew up the entire powder mill to conceal his actions.
That's speculative, Caleb observed, but it does make sense. And it suggests that getting large quantities of gunpowder into the Empire isn't going to be as easy for Clintan as simply sending in lunatics willing to blow themselves up as long as they get to kill as many Carizians as possible. Of course, the reverse side of that mark is that we don't know how much powder was diverted from Hayratha. There could still be tons of it sitting around somewhere.
Indeed there could be, Your Majesty, Wave Thunder nodded, which is why I have my best agents and all of our resources looking for it.
He didn't add that all of our resources included Owl Snarks. In addition, we're trying to make all city guardsmen aware of the need to look for anything out of the ordinary. They don't have to use wagons to get bombs into position, especially if they can work out some reliable way to set them off with a delayed timer of some kind. And even a fairly small explosion in a crowded market square will inflict a lot of casualties. This time around, Clintan ordered his Rakurai to specifically target senior clergy and secular leaders. All the dead and maimed civilians were simply a happy side effect of that, according to Master Anders. Next time the bastards may simply choose to go for as much death and destruction as they can inflict. At the same time, we have to be on the lookout for completely different techniques. For example, If they could get their hands on our own gunpowder, they may manage to get access to our grenades as well. For that matter, they could make grenades or similar small explosive devices of their own without much trouble. An attack like that couldn't kill anywhere near as many people as their wagon bombs, but they'd also be harder to detect, and they'd probably be better at penetrating any security we set up. Heads nodded soberly, and Caleb's expression was grim. He wondered how the rest of his counselors were going to react when they discovered that a Rakurai with four grenades under his tunic had entered Chiraeth Cathedral less than 26 hours before this very meeting, waited for Archbishop Powell Brainer to arrive to celebrate Mass, and then seized one of the processional candles and used it to light the fuse. He'd managed to kill only 3 people, but that was only because Brainer and 2 other men had tackled him and smothered most of the explosion with their own bodies. "I'm afraid one of the precautions we're going to have to take, and you're not going to like it, Michael," Wave Thunder, who did know about Brainer's death, said, looking directly at Michael Stainer. "We'll be stationing guardsmen outside all public buildings, including cathedrals and churches, and requiring anyone entering to demonstrate he's not carrying a bomb under his tunic." "I won't have armed guards outside God's house," Stainer said flatly. But then even the redoubtable archbishop jerked in his chair as Caleb's open palm slapped the tabletop like a gunshot. "Perhaps you won't, Michael," the Emperor said even more flatly, "but I will." Their eyes locked, and the index finger of the hand which had slapped the table tapped it in emphatic time with Caleb's words as he continued, "You may choose to risk your life in the service of God, and I'll respect you for it, even as I cringe inside every time I think about how readily you expose yourself to murderers like these Rakurai of Clinton's. That's your option, though, Michael, and I won't dictate to you. But you have no right to expose other people to the same risk. We're not talking about 3 men with knives this time. We're talking about people who blow up entire city squares, Michael. I am not opening the doors of God's house to that kind of wholesale murder and massacre. Don't fight me on this one. You'll lose." Silence hovered tensely for long, still moments. Then, finally, Stainer bowed his head. "I hadn't thought of it exactly that way," he admitted. "I still don't like it. In fact, I hate the very thought, but you're right, I suppose." "We don't like the thought either, Michael," Charlian said gently. "And if we can find a better way, we will. But for now, it has to be this way." Stainer nodded silently, and Caleb inhaled deeply as the council chamber's tension eased perceptibly. "We'll look forward to hearing anything more you turn up on this front, Bin Zamin. In the meantime, though, we can't afford to let our concern over those murders divert us from other problems. I'm sure that's at least partly what Clintan hopes to accomplish. So since we're not going to let that bastard have anything he wants, I suggest we turn our attention elsewhere. For one thing, I'd like to hear anything you and Travis can tell us about the situation in Sidamark."
"Of course, Your Majesty," Pine Hollow said after a glance at Wave Thunder. "Bin Zamin and I have been looking at reports from certain of our sources in the Republic."
Pine Hollow hadn't yet had as much experience as his predecessor in not looking at Captain Athroy's when he made comments like that, and his eyes flicked briefly in Merlin's direction. It was only a very brief glance, however, and he continued calmly.
"We don't have anything like detailed information, I'm afraid, but it would appear the Group of Four intends to strike at the Republic very soon now."
Expressions turned grave once more, and the new First Counselor shrugged.
"It seems evident from the reports that someone, almost certainly agents of the Inquisition, is skillfully fanning public unrest and anger directed first and foremost at the Carisian community in Sidar City and the other eastern provinces, but also at reformists in general. The most telling aspect, in my opinion, is that the propaganda we've become more recently aware of directly links Lord Protector Gregor and his government to the support and protection of heretics and blasphemers throughout the Republic. And you may find this of particular interest, Alvino, he said, glancing at Ironhill. But they're also emphasizing the way in which the Carisian immigrants are taking food out of our babies' mouths and somehow managing to simultaneously make the consequences of Clintran's embargo our fault. That's insane, the Carisian keeper of the purse said, and Pine Hollow chuckled harshly. And you were of the opinion propaganda has to make sense to be effective?
No, I suppose not,
Ironhill sighed. And what happened at Ithria, especially the destruction of the port, is going to play into their propaganda efforts as well, Charlian observed. I'm not sure how, but no doubt they'll figure out a way to suggest we're about to do the same thing to the Republic, with Stonar's connivance, for some nefarious reason of our own.
Probably, Caleb agreed. And that being the case, what do we do?
He looked around the council table. Suggestions, anyone? 2. Royal Palace, City of Talkira, Kingdom of Delphirac. Tellersburg Palace, City of Tellersburg, Kingdom of Old Caris. And HMS Destiny 54, Thal Bay, Kingdom of Tyrell. What is it, Philip? Iris Davin asked, looking up with a welcoming smile from the flowers she'd been arranging to greet the Duke of Corus as he entered the library. Spring was coming on apace, and the early season wildflowers crowning the hills around the castle above Lake Erdan reminded her, fleetingly, of the brilliant blossoms of her homeland. They were a pallid substitute, yet they echoed at least the ghost of Coruscant, and she had spent several hours collecting them that morning, escorted by Tobis Raymere and one of his men. She had been arranging them ever since, and singing softly, something she seldom did since her father's death, as she worked. Philip Osgood knew that, which was one of the reasons he hated having to disturb her, especially with this. "I'm afraid something's come up, Iris," he said, "something we need to talk about." Her smile faded as his tone registered. She laid the flowers on the table beside the trio of vases she'd been filling and wiped her hands on the apron she wore over her gown. "What is it?" she repeated in a very different tone. "Sit down," he invited, pointing at one of the well-upholstered but worn-looking chairs. "This may take a while." "Why?" she asked, sitting in the indicated chair and watching him with intense hazel eyes as he turned another chair backwards and sat straddling it, forearms propped on the top of its back. "Because we have to discuss something we've both been avoiding," he said gravely. "Something you've been dancing around and that I've let you dance around." "That sounds ominous." Her effort to inject a light note into her voice failed, and she folded her arms across her chest. "But in that case, I imagine the best way to do this will be for you to come straight to the point," she said. In that moment, she looked very like her father, Corris thought. She had her mother's eyes and high yet delicate cheekbones, but that hair came straight from her father, and so did the strong chin, softened, thank God, into a more feminine version in her case. And the look in those eyes came from Hector Dakin as well. It was the look Hector had worn when the time came to set aside theories and nuanced understandings, when it was time to make decisions by which men lived or died. It grieved Corris in many ways to see that look in Iris' eyes, but it was a vast relief as well. "All right, I will come to the point," he replied, and inhaled deeply. "Iris, I know you blamed Caleb Armagh for your father's death. We haven't discussed it in some time, but it seemed to me your confidence that he was responsible for it may have waned a bit over the past year or so." He paused, one eyebrow arched. After a moment she nodded ever so slightly. "I've entertained the possibility that there could be other explanations." "I thought that that was what was happening," Cora said. "I haven't pushed you on it for a lot of reasons, but one of them, frankly, was that if my suspicions were correct, then having you publicly and vocally suspicious of Caleb was your best protection. Unfortunately, it doesn't look like it was protection enough." "What do you mean?" Those eyes were even more like her father's, and he sighed. "Iris, Caleb and Charlian of Caris didn't have your father murdered. Zaspar Clintan did." For a moment, her expression didn't even flicker. Then her eyes widened, less in disbelief than in surprise at the flat confidence in his tone, he thought. She looked at him in silence, and then it was her turn to draw a deep, slightly shaky breath and sit back in her chair. "You have proof of that? Proof that he personally ordered your father's assassination?" "No," Corris admitted. "Very strong suggestive evidence that he planned it?" "Yes." "What sort of evidence?" she asked in a cold, dispassionate voice, which had no business coming from a young woman who wouldn't be 20 years old for another month yet. "First, let's think about his possible motives for doing something like that," Corris responded. "Your father was losing, Iris." "No, he wasn't losing. He had lost, and he knew he had. I wasn't there because he'd sent me away with you and Davin, but I have reports from trustworthy agents which all confirm Caleb and Duke Anvil Rock are telling the truth when they say Prince Hector had contacted Caleb to open surrender negotiations. I'm not going to tell you Caleb of Caris is a saint, because I don't really believe in saints, and I won't argue that your father wouldn't still be alive today if Caleb hadn't invaded Coruscant, since that almost certainly created the circumstances which led to his murder. But I will tell you Caleb Armagh was about to get everything he'd invaded to get, and that he's clearly smart enough to know that killing your father in that fashion at that time would have been the worst, stupidest thing he could possibly have done. But the things that would have made it stupid from Caleb's perspective would have all been positive outcomes from Clintan's viewpoint." Corris held up an index finger. "One, if your father had reached an accommodation with Caleb, even if he'd planned on denouncing it as non-binding at the first opportunity, since any promises would have been made to an excommunicate, it would have made him another Naaman in Clintan's view. That would have been enough by itself to drive him into a frenzy, but there was even worse from his perspective. The way he would have seen it, it wouldn't simply have been a case of the prince the Group of Four had anointed as Mother Church's champion against the Corisian blasphemer, cutting a deal with the blasphemer in question to save his own crown. It would have encouraged others to do exactly the same thing." He extended the second finger of the same hand. "Two, if your father had reached an accommodation with Caleb and decided, for whatever reason, that he had no choice but to abide by it, Caris conquest or control, at least of Coruscant, would have been enormously simplified." He extended his third finger. "Three, if Caleb assassinated your father, however, or if someone else did and Caleb simply ended up blamed for it, then instead of becoming another traitor to the Group of Four and another example of someone reaching an accommodation with Caris, your father became a martyr of Mother Church." His fourth finger rose. "Four, your father may not have been much beloved outside Coruscant, but he was remarkably popular with his own subjects. If Caleb had him murdered, it would arouse intense resentment among those subjects. That would lead to unrest, which would require substantial numbers of Carisian troops to suppress, and that would almost certainly lead to incidents between those troops and the people of Coruscant, which would only strengthen your people's resentment and anger. Violent confrontations and incidents would increase, bloodshed would rise, and Coruscant would become a sinkhole for the Carisian military resources that would be tied down there and not available for use against a group of four anywhere else. Of course, hundreds or even thousands of Coruscantians would have been killed in the process. But from Clintan's perspective, that would simply have been the cost of doing business. He paused for a moment, and then slowly extended his thumb as well. And five. By killing your father after he'd sent you and Davin out of Coruscant to keep you safe, and by making sure your brother died at the same time, Clintan created a situation in which the legitimate heir to the throne of Coruscant was a minor child outside the princedom, and under the church's direct or indirect control. Davin's exile from Coruscant guaranteed the fragmented authority and legitimacy that led to the Northern Conspiracy, Iris. It contributed directly to the bloodshed and executions in Coruscant, and it left Davin conveniently parked where the group of four could make whatever future use of him seemed most valuable. He let his hand fall, and Iris sat, gazing at him silently. From her expression, he was confident he hadn't told her anything which hadn't already crossed her own mind, but still she sat looking at him, then cocked her head. "That's not proof, Philip. It's a description of why it might have made sense to a man like Clintan to murder Father and Hector. A very convincing description, I'll grant that. And after watching what he did to the Wilson family and his other rivals in the vicarate, I'm certainly not prepared to argue that the fact that he's a vicar of God would have slowed him down for a moment. The man's a butcher, a tyrant, a murderer, and a monster." The flat, almost emotionless detachment of her voice only made it even more terrible, Corus thought. Yet none of that constitutes proof he had Father and Hector killed. "I'm willing to admit it's time to consider the possibility that Caleb didn't do it, but that's a long way from deciding Clintan did." "Your father taught you well," Corrie said with a small, sad smile. "Always look for the other possibilities, the less obvious one. Never decide something must be the truth simply because you want it to be." "Father also taught me never to trust anyone completely," she said, looking into his eyes. That was his very first rule, his most important single axiom. But he set it aside in your case, and I'm willing to do the same. Only I'm not prepared to accept that simply because I trust you. You have to be right." Corus' heart swelled with pride, and he looked at her, and he nodded. "My God, what a queen you would have made," he said softly. "Your father and I talked about that once. He hated Charlian, you know. Though it wasn't really personal. She was just in the way, and he knew she'd never rest until she'd avenged her father's death. But he admired her, too, deeply, and I think he had seriously considered trying to change the law of succession in Coruscant." The Earl shook his head with a smile. "Only he told me he'd decided against it because he didn't think Safehold could survive you and Charlian at the same time unless you were both on the same side. And that wasn't going to happen." Iris' eyes softened, and her mouth trembled ever so slightly. But then she shook her head and unfolded her arms to point a finger at him. "No courtier's tricks, Philip. You're not going to distract me that easily. You said you had strong, suggestive evidence. Show it to me." "Of course." Corus gave her a seated bow, then turned his head towards the closed library door. "Robert! Tobias!" The door opened a moment later, and Tobias Raymere and Corus' valet, Robert Seablanket, walked through it.
Sea Blanket was a thin man with stoop shoulders and a long nose. His brown hair, touched with white, was beginning to thin, but the neatly trimmed beard he favoured to hide the scar on his jaw was still dark and full. Iris had always thought he was one of the most lugubrious men she had ever seen, and she'd never really warmed to him. "I'm sure you will recall my hiring Master Sea Blanket when we passed through Shwe on our way here," Corris said, turning back to Iris as Sea Blanket and Raymere crossed the library and halted behind him. "I was fortunate to find a Coruscandian suitable to my requirements that far from home, wasn't I?" "The thought had crossed my mind, yes," she replied slowly. "And if you'll pardon my saying so, it seemed a little suspicious." She looked across the Earl's shoulder at Sea Blanket. "It struck me that if someone wanted to plant a spy on you, that might have been one way to go about it. On the other hand, I've known you since I was a little girl. It seemed unlikely that same possibility wouldn't have occurred to you." "I'm afraid there are times even I can be a bit gullible and overly trusting," Corris said with a sigh. "And this, alas, was one of them. In fact, Iris, Robert is an agent of the Inquisition." He watched the young woman's eyes widen in sudden alarm, but continued unhurriedly. "He was, in fact, specifically assigned to worm his way into my employment by Willem Reyno himself. Unfortunately for Archbishop Willem, however, when Robert first encountered the Grand Inquisitor's personal service, he already had an employer. Your father." Despite her formidable self-control, Iris' jaw dropped. She stared at Corris for a moment, then whipped her eyes back to the valet, who suddenly looked much less lugubrious. In fact, he smiled at her, eyes touched by an amused light she'd never seen in them before, and bowed deeply. "He worked for Father?" she more than half blurted. "Exactly," Corris shrugged. "It's an interesting thing about the Inquisition, Iris. They plant spies and agents everywhere, and they're very good at finding disaffected people to inform on others. Yet, until at least very recently, it never seems to have occurred to them that anyone else might plant spies on them. I think it has to do with the arrogance of power. They're so busy dealing with all the things they're doing to other people that they never consider the possibility of what other people might do to them, or what steps those other people might take to protect themselves against the Inquisition's spies. And they did make a minor recruiting error in Robert's case." "They did?" she asked in a fascinated tone. "Oh, indeed they did." Corris practically purred. Yet there was an odd, icy edge under his obvious satisfaction. "You see, Robert is a Coruscandian, born and raised. But his mother was born in Ha Chong, where his grandfather was beaten to death on the very steps of his village church while the local inquisitor looked on. And his crime?" Corris looked into her eyes. "The squire, beating him to death, had wanted to bed his youngest daughter. She had refused. He had ignored her refusal. And her father had had the unspeakable temerity to protest his 13-year-old daughter's rape. That daughter was Robert's mother." Iris' eyes flitted back to Sea Blanket and saw the truth as cold, bitter memory and hate quenched the humour which had flickered in his eyes. "I won't bother you with the details of how his mother and her two sisters managed to reach Coruscant, Iris. That's not really my story to tell anyway. But they did get to Mantia, eventually, where your grandfather employed all of them on the palace staff, and she married one of his armsmen. So when Robert came to your father and told him he'd been approached by an inquisitor about becoming a spy inside your grandfather's household, your father told him to agree. That was over 30 years ago. They soon realized what a prize he was and pulled him out of Coruscant to use other places before I ever came into your father's service.
He became very valuable to them over the years. Valuable enough that it took very little effort on his part to plant the notion that he be sent to Shui to infiltrate Davin's court in exile. After all, he certainly knew enough about Coruscant and about Coruscantian politics to be perfect for the job. And he'd been a trusted agent of the Inquisition since long before I became your father's spymaster, so even though he'd grown up in your grandfather's palace, I wouldn't recognize him when I saw him. It was, alas, childishly easy for him to worm himself into my confidence, and he's been reporting exactly what I wanted him to report ever since. Iris leaned back, shaking her head slowly. Not in denial, but in surprise. Philip, I'm trying, but it's a little hard to believe even you could be audacious enough to plant, what, a double agent on the office of the Inquisition?
I did nothing of the sort, Your Highness. First, he's not a double agent. Technically, he's a triple agent.
Corus protested with a smile, raising both hands in an eloquent gesture of innocence.
Besides, I had nothing to do with his original recruitment by the Inquisition. Your father did, when he and Robert were both about your age, in fact.
His smile disappeared, replaced by a far sadder expression. I learned a great deal from your father, Iris. I'd like to think he learned a few things from me in return, too. Yet the one lesson neither of us learned until it was too late is that some things in this world are genuinely more important than the great game. The truth is, I don't think your father ever did learn that. But watching what happened to him, seeing what's happening to this entire world, has taught me there are. Your father made mistakes, Iris. Even the smartest man can do that, especially when he's blinded by ambition, and, forgive me, he was. I speak with a certain degree of experience because I helped him make a lot of those mistakes and shared a lot of those ambitions. But your father wasn't simply my prince. He was my friend, and that bastard in Zion had him and his son, my godson, butchered on the streets of his own capital just so he could blame it on someone else. And now he wants to murder Davin, too.
Davin?
Iris gasped. She jerked up out of her chair, her face pale, and one hand rose to the base of her throat. That's my strong, suggestive evidence, Iris. I've been sent orders to help clear the way for a party of assassins to murder Davin. What my orders don't tell me is that after Davin is dead, I'm going to be killed as well. That will both remove any unfortunate witnesses who might know a little too much about how the tragedy came to occur, and allow Clintan to argue that, just like your cousin Anvil Rock and his friend Tartarian, I've betrayed Coruscant in return for some promised reward from Caleb and Charlian Armak. Unfortunately for Clintan, the man who's been charged with denouncing me to King Zaemes and the Inquisition is none other than my valet, who will, unfortunately, have become aware of my treasonous intentions just too late to prevent your brother's murder. Oh, and as a crowning touch, the murderers, all of whom will either perish in the attempt or die under the Inquisition's urgent interrogation, will be Carisians. Or at least, all of them were born Carisians, although most of them have grown up and spent most of their lives here on the mainland. That's a nice refinement, don't you think? Iris sank slowly back into the chair, eyes huge, and Corus shrugged. I could be making all of this up, lying to you, but I think you know I'm not. And even though I can't show you a written order from Clintan to have your father and young Hector murdered, I think the pattern we're seeing is clear enough, don't you? We can't let him kill Davin, Philip. For once, Iris Dakin looked as young as her years, her eyes filling with tears. Please, he's all I have left, all the family I have, and he's such a little boy. He doesn't deserve any of this.
I know,
He reached out and took her hand. I know, Iris. And Robert and Tobias and I will do anything we can to protect him and you. But we're going to need help, and lots of it, or all we'll be able to do is to die in your defense. And I hope you'll forgive me for saying it. He smiled a small, crooked smile. But I'd really prefer not to do that. Especially not if there's a chance of getting away alive in a way that will piss Zaspar Clintan off badly enough. Pure apoplexy might just kill the son of a bitch. Pardon my language. Help? She repeated, ignoring the last three words, her expression confused. Who's going to be able to help us now? Well, it happens that if you're willing to let me ask for assistance, I have a friend who might just be able to do a little something for us after all. You're joking, Travis Olson said, looking back and forth between Merlin Athroyes and Binzamin Reis. Aren't you? Does he look like he's joking? Baron Wave Thunder demanded, jabbing a thumb in Merlin's direction. No, but... Duke Pinehollow's voice trailed off, and Wave Thunder chuckled. All this new information access takes some getting used to, doesn't it? You can say that again, Pinehollow shook his head. And, to be honest, the fact that I'm still playing catch-up in so many areas doesn't help. I haven't had as much time to practice with this comm as I should have because I'm so busy discovering all the balls Duke Grey Harbour had in the air. He shook his head again. I always respected the Duke, but I hadn't even begun to guess everything he'd been up to. You do have a hard example to live up to, my lord, Merlin agreed soberly. I think you'll do well enough, though, and I hate to say it, but having you as a member of the Inner Circle is going to help a great deal in the long run. I'll grant you that it's not going to hurt any, Pinehollow said with an off-center smile. I do wish I'd known about it while Narman was still alive, though. And I wish I could tell Baron Shandire about it now. The Emeraldian Earl chuckled. Hal still hasn't figured out why your counter-espionage efforts here in Old Caris were so damned effective. Hopefully someday we'll have the chance to explain that to him, Merlin said with an answering smile. For right now, though, there's this other minor matter. Of course there is. Pine Hollow gave himself a shake. I'm still having a little trouble believing it, though. Well, the messenger wyvern's on its way right now, Merlin shrugged. The snark owl has keeping an eye on Iris and Corys picked up on the key words Caris, Caleb, Clintan, and assassination when they discussed what to do. That was enough to flag the entire conversation to me and Binzamin, and I'll ask Owl to shoot the visual and the audio over to you later tonight. But the key point is that they're asking for asylum. I don't think Iris is quite prepared to promise she or Davin will swear fealty to Caleb and Charlian, or accept Coruscant's permanent incorporation into the Empire. But from what I can see, she's at least confident we won't murder her baby brother. From her perspective, that's a major step up from the situation they're in. I can see where that might be true, Pinehollow said feelingly. The question is, what we do about it? I think the first order of business is probably to discuss it with Caleb and Charlian, Merlin replied. On the other hand, I've discovered there are times when a little preparation work before you get around to the first order of business is indicated. Having a policy ready to suggest strikes me as an especially good idea in this case. And you want me to do the suggesting, I see. Pinehollow smiled. Do you really expect them to react that adversely? On the contrary, I expect them to endorse the suggestion wholeheartedly. I just thought that, as the Empire's brand new First Counselor, with this opportunity to demonstrate your mettle coming along, you might want to take advantage of it. That's Merlin for you, Wave Thunder snorted. Always looking out for opportunities by which we can advance ourselves.
Remind me to tell you about the first opportunity he gave me some day, my lord.
Now, Benjamin, let's not be bringing up the past, Merlin said severely, and turned back to Pine Hollow. What I've been thinking, my lord.
Sir Duncan?
Yes, Hector?
Admiral Sir Duncan Yearley looked up from the captain's reports in front of him, as Lieutenant Applin Armock stepped into his day cabin. A messenger from the Port Admiral's just come aboard, sir. He has a dispatch for you.
And I presume there's some reason you haven't already handed it to me?
As a matter of fact, sir, I'm afraid you'll have to sign for it personally. Yearley's eyebrows rose. He considered his young flag lieutenant for a moment, then shrugged.
Very well. I suppose you should ask this messenger to step into the cabin.
Aye, sir. Applin Armack disappeared for a few seconds, then returned escorting a full commander.
The plot thickens, Yearley murmured, at sight of the messenger's seniority.
Commander Jenkins, Sir Duncan, Applin Armack said.
I see you have a dispatch for me, Commander.
Yes, sir, I do. Jenkins saluted, then opened an attaché case and extracted a heavy canvas envelope. A paper label was stitched across the open end to hold it closed, and he laid it on Yearley's desk. The Admiral looked at it for a moment, then dipped his pen in the inkwell and scribbled his name across the label.
Very good, Sir Duncan.
Thank you, Jenkins said, retrieving the envelope and examining the signature briefly but closely. Then he drew a small knife and carefully slit the stitches which had closed the envelope. There was another smaller envelope inside, and he withdrew it and handed it to Yearley before returning the outer envelope to his attaché case.
I was instructed to inform you, Sir Duncan, that Admiral White Ford requests an estimate of your readiness to deal with this matter within the next 2 hours.
I see. Yearley weighed the envelope in his fingers. It didn't seem all that heavy, but then again, orders never did. Until the time came to carry them out.
Hector, would you please see Commander Jenkins back to his boat?
Of course, Sir Duncan.
Thank you, and Commander.
Yearley's gaze moved back to Jenkins.
Inform Admiral Whiteford that I'll report to him as quickly as possible.
I will, Sir Duncan. Thank you. The commander saluted again and withdrew, escorted by Applin Armack. Yearley watched them go, and when the cabin door closed behind them, opened the second envelope, extracted the half-dozen sheets of paper, and began to read.
"Yes, Sir Duncan,"
Applin Armack said, stepping back into the day cabin 10 minutes later. "Sylvester said you wanted to see me." The lieutenant, Yearley observed with some amusement, was clearly on fire with curiosity about the mysterious dispatch. It was equally obvious that nothing on earth could have prevailed upon Applin Armack to admit his curiosity.
"I did," he acknowledged. "I think we're going to be a bit busy for the next hour or so, Hector."
"Of course, sir."
"How?" "I am requested and required to report to Admiral Whiteford within no more than 2 hours' time the squadron's readiness state and whether or not we can depart Thull Bay with the evening tide."
Applin Armack's eyes widened slightly. Destiny had only officially left dockyard hands the day before, and, as always happened these days, she had hemorrhaged manpower while she was being repaired. Captain Lathick was almost 70 men short of a full complement, and the chance of his coming up with that many men in the next 6 hours ranged from non-existent to something somewhat less than that. Then there was the minor problem of how they provisioned and stored the ship in that same 6 hours, which, frankly, sounded impossible to him. There could, however, be only one possible response from any King's officer to such an order.
"Of course, sir," Lieutenant Applin Armack said calmly. "I'll just go and find the flag captain, shall I?"
November, Year of God, 895. 1. HMS Destiny, 54. Shula Strait,
and Tellisberg Palace, City of Tellisberg, Kingdom of Old Caris.
Gentlemen, thank you for coming.
Most of the faces around the polished wooden table in Sir Duncan Yearley's day cabin were worn with weariness, grooved with lines of fatigue, and adorned with at least a day or two of stubble. Yearley, however, was clean-shaven and brisk, his eyes bright without any sign of exhaustion, which was something of a miracle under the circumstances. Somehow, and most of his captains didn't know how really even now, his squadron had made its departure time, sailing on the evening tide almost exactly five days earlier. Since then, for reasons none of them knew, Yearley had driven them as if Shan Wei herself were in pursuit and gaining steadily. He had informed them that he intended to be off Shula Strait within 28 days, which most of them had regarded as an outright impossibility. Instead, he had done it in only 26, which had required him to maintain an average speed of almost 8.5 knots. Topgallants, royals, staysails, studding sails, he had set every scrap of canvas that would draw, and refused to reduce sail until he absolutely had to. He had even ignored the Navy tradition of reefing down, reducing sail and taking a precautionary reef in his topsails every night, lest some squall, unseen in the darkness, overtake a ship under too much canvas and rip the masts out of her, or even drive her bodily under. He hadn't told them why. He'd only told them how, and then driven them like a slave master, and, to their total astonishment, they'd actually done it. Now the squadron ships lay hove to in the mouth of the strait, their crews sunning on deck despite the brisk, chill weather, while they luxuriated in the brief, well-earned, and badly needed respite, and all his captains repaired aboard Destiny, where, just perhaps, they might finally learn what all of this was about. One captain was missing. Captain Davin Shailton's Thunderbolt had lost her main topgallant and royal masts when she had been hit by a sudden gust before she could reduce sail. Some of Yearley's officers had expected him to take Shailton's head off for letting that happen, but the Admiral wasn't a fool. He knew whose fault it was, and so he had simply signalled Shailton to continue at his best speed to a rendezvous point 50 miles south of Sarm Bank in the approaches to Sarmath Keep, although why anyone in his right mind would want to go there was something of a puzzle. Hopefully they were about to discover that puzzle's answer. "I'm sure all of you have wondered what could have possessed me to push our people this hard," Sir Duncan said, as his steward and flag lieutenant silently and efficiently provided each captain with a snifter of brandy. "I can now tell you at least part of the reason, although there are other portions of our orders which must remain confidential for a while longer." The captains glanced at each other. Secret orders weren't exactly unheard of, but they were more heard of than actually seen. And orders whose contents couldn't be shared aboard vessels hundreds of miles from anywhere in particular were even rarer. Who was going to overhear any careless talk out here, after all? Yearley watched those thoughts go through his officers' minds, then cleared his throat gently, recalling their attention to him. "The squadron is ordered to attack, seize, and destroy Sarmath Keep," he told them. "This isn't simply a raid, gentlemen. It's an all-out attack, which will leave nothing but rubble where the fortifications are now. In addition, it will include the seizure of any shipping we may encounter in Sarmath itself and the destruction of the city's docks, wharves, and warehouses." There was silence for a moment, and then Captain Lathick took a sip of brandy and broke it. "Excuse me, Sir Duncan, but may we know why we're to destroy Sarmath?" His tone could not have been more respectful, yet his expression made it clear that he couldn't think of any conceivable reason for the operation. Sarmath, in the earldom of Chalts, was, admittedly, the second largest seaport of the kingdom of Delphirac, but that wasn't saying much. The Sam River, which emptied into the Southern Ocean at Samoth, was over 300 miles long, flowing all the way from the Saman Mountains in the Duchy of Yath. It was navigable, by anything larger than a rowboat at any rate, for only about a third of its length, however, and Samoth itself was little more than a sleeping fishing port, with occasional delusions of grandeur when a particularly ambitious Duke of Charles started trying, usually with a depressing lack of success, to attract trade away from Ferraid. At the moment, it was probably even more of a ghost town than Ferraid, thanks to the systematic Carisian destruction of the Delpharacan merchant marine and Clintan's embargo. Nor was Sam Keep any more impressive than the city it had been built to protect.
"I can't answer that question completely at this time, Robert," Yerli said after a moment. "I will tell you, however, and this is not to be discussed aboard your ships, even with your first officers, that the primary purpose of the attack is to serve as a distraction. While everyone's attention is hopefully focused on our noisy efforts to properly wreck everything in sight, we'll be sending a small party up the Sam River in boats. The reason I say this isn't to be discussed outside this cabin is that I want none of our men who might be going ashore during the raid itself to know anything about it. I trust their hearts completely. I'm a little less confident about their tongues." He smiled briefly. "I want no careless comments ashore to alert any Delpharacan that we might be hanging about to recover those boats." The captains glanced at each other again. It was amazing how gaining additional information hadn't left them any less in the dark. "I realize you're all puzzled by the purpose of our orders," Yerli continued. "I promise I'll inform you more fully as soon as my own instructions permit. In the meantime, however, it's vital that we carry out our attack no later than 12 days from today." One or two sets of eyes widened, and he smiled thinly. "Perhaps you can see now why haste has been so imperative."
"I think you could safely say that, Sir Duncan, yes," Lathic said dryly, and two of the others chuckled. Even at the insane rate of speed Yerli had maintained, it would require another 6 or 7 days just to reach Samoth, and there was no guarantee they'd be able to maintain that speed. In fact, the odds were against it.
"I thought I could," Yerli said in an equally dry tone. "Still, I believe we can probably spend the time to properly enjoy the dinner Sylvist promises me will be the high point of our entire voyage before we get back underway. I've taken the liberty of informing your first officers by signal that you'll be remaining aboard to dine, and I'm confident they'll take the opportunity to see to it that your people are properly fed as well. Of course, we'll be driving as hard as ever as soon as you've returned to your ships. I'm sure, Carisians being Carisians, that there'll be quite a bit of grumbling among your ships' companies when the people realize that. However, you may inform them that their majesties have graciously consented to pay head money for every member of the garrison taken into temporary custody and to pay prize money for destroyed vessels and warehoused goods based upon a fair valuation." It was his turn to chuckle. "I know it won't be much, but I also know Carisian seamen. Telling them they'll have a few extra marks rattling around in their pockets if they do well always seems to cheer them up, doesn't it?"
"What is it, Merlin?" Caleb Armagh's question was broken in the middle by a prodigious yawn. He pushed himself up in bed, careful to avoid disturbing Charlian, and grimaced as he looked out the bedchamber window. "What time is it?" he demanded in a mildly ominous tone.
"It'll be dawn in another hour," Merlin replied over the comm earplug.
"I'm going to assume there's a good reason I'm not still blissfully asleep," Caleb remarked, climbing out of bed and shrugging into a light robe as he walked across the room and sat on the windowsill, looking out at the peaceful pre-dawn garden.
I don't think I'm quite as ready to assume there's a good reason you're not still blissfully asleep, however. Correct me if I'm wrong, but aren't we in the middle of that compulsory downtime you're supposed to take every night? Do I have to go ahead and sick owl on you to report you when you don't take it? Actually, we're not halfway through it, Merlin replied with scrupulous accuracy. We're closer to two-thirds of the way through it, if you want to be persnickety about it. Oh, that's much better. Caleb's lips twitched, but he firmed them back up in a disapproving frown. There was a reason I promulgated that particular arrogant imperial decree, if you'll recall, Sajin Merlin. And it just happens we have several other people now who can cover things while you sleep.
That's true, Merlin admitted. In rebuttal, however, I'll just point out that all of them happen to be in the same time zone at the moment, so I told Owl that if anything urgent comes up in the middle of the night, he's supposed to give it to me rather than wake up one of you flesh and bloods who need actual sleep, not just the opportunity to rest your diodes. Besides, I've gotten quite a bit of rest since I got back to the cave, you know. In fact, I'm getting too damned much rest at the moment. Caleb folded his arms and glowered at the garden, looking for some logical way to attack Merlin's reasoning. Unfortunately, none occurred to him. All right, he said finally. You got me. This time. Now what's so damned urgent you decided to wake this flesh and blood up at this godforsaken hour? I could have gotten at least another solid hour of sleep, you know.
Owl's just spotted what looks an awful lot like it must be Clintan's assassination team. Any trace of humour had disappeared from Merlin's tone, and Caleb sat up straighter, his eyes narrowing. I'm not absolutely positive, but we've planted a couple of parasites on them. If these are the people we're looking for, and I can't think of why anyone else would be travelling to Delphirac from the Temple Lands this time of year, especially with snow all over the roads in both havens, they're bound to say something to confirm it. What makes Owl think this could be them? Aside from the fact that they're riding through the snow and ice, that is. There are 15 of them, all in a single party, and 12 of them have Carisian accents. They're making it a point to stop at church hostels along the way, and when they do, they make sure the staff hears those accents of theirs. And they're dropping the occasional Carisian mark when they pay their tab before they head on down the road. And, just as another little indicator that they're probably the people we're looking for, they're being very careful to let people know, or think anyway, that they came out of the Republic. Obviously, Clintan's decided that suggesting active collusion between Lord Protector Gregor and Karis may give his operation there an extra boost. Unfortunately, whatever they may be suggesting to the people they meet along the way, Owl has the same crew getting off a Ha Chong registry ship, whose immediately previous port of call was in Malansath, not the Republic, in the Duchy of Malachi 2-5 days ago. Now, I suppose really sneaky Sidiamachian assassins might have decided to travel a couple of thousand miles west, overland, to get aboard a ship in the Ha Chong Empire, and then sail back east for 1,500 miles before they head south for their real destination. But I don't know, Caleb. It seems a little roundabout to me. Was Nimu Alban as much of a smartass as you are? Caleb inquired pleasantly. Probably not. She was a lot more junior than I am, of course. Oh, of course, Caleb agreed with a nod, and rubbed his chin for a moment, thinking. How did you put all of that together? He asked after a moment. I'm not complaining, you understand, but... He let his voice trail off, and sensed Merlin's distant shrug. It's not really all that surprising. I've had Owl conducting continual reconnaissance of all three continents. I don't want him wasting processor power trying to actually monitor that much area on any real-time basis. But he's got a subroutine set up to store the imagery in Romulus' computer core as it comes in. That way it's available for us to backtrack just about anything we want to, if it turns out there's a reason we should. Things like individual horsemen don't even show up in the raw imagery. But once he starts enhancing and manipulating it, he can turn up a surprising amount of detail and do a lot about backtracking targets once they've been pointed out to him. He's beginning to show more initiative within his assigned parameters, too. Bin Zamin and I instructed him to cover inns and hostels in Delphirac with parasites and listen for key words that might identify the assassins, and he decided, on his own, to place parasites in the temple hostels on the main roads into Delphirac from Sodar and the Desnarian Empire as well. Then he started moving farther back up the line without mentioning it to us. One of the ostlers in a hostel he had wired for sound waited until this particular group had left, and then described them as Langhor-damned Carizians, probably heretics, the lot of them, to one of his co-workers. That popped through Al's filters, and he started going through the data, including what he had of the group this fellow was describing talking to each other from his other parasites, until he could locate and positively ID them. Once he had them, he simply ran back through the recorded imagery, backtracking them until the first time he picked them up, which, as I say, was in Malachi. He was able to track the ship back to Malansath, but it looks like they must have gone aboard during one of the blizzards that rolled through there last month. "It sounds to me like we got lucky," Caleb said. "We got lucky because Al's getting better. Still, you're right. On the other hand, we've got a lot denser fence along the Delphiracan border, and Al's keeping a real-time watch over Talkyra itself. If we hadn't picked them up now, we'd have picked them up then, I think." "You hope, you mean?" Caleb snorted. He thought again for several more seconds. "So what does this imply for your plans?" he asked after a moment. "My biggest concern is the fact that they're moving sooner than we thought they would, or faster, anyway," Merlin pointed out. "By my calculations, they'll reach Talkyra sometime around the 15th, a good 2 days earlier than we'd allowed for. For that matter, Yerli's squadron isn't even supposed to hit Sarm Keep until the 13th. I realize he's a little ahead of schedule, but whether or not the wind will let him stay that way is another question. And then there's the minor fact that nobody in Talkyra has heard back from us yet." Caleb sensed another of those distant shrugs. "I think I'm going to have to go ahead and move down to the Sundhorns to be a little closer to the scene, just in case. And it's probably time I went and had that conversation with Duke Corris, too. In a manner of speaking, of course." 2. Royal Palace, City of Talkyra, Kingdom of Delphirac. Philip Osgood was a light sleeper. He always had been, and his tendency to sleep less soundly than most had only grown stronger over his years as a spymaster. Hector Dakin had teased him about it once upon a time, pointing out that it was probably the result of an increasingly guilty conscience. The Duke of Corris had responded that it had far less to do with guilty consciences than with a growing familiarity with and appreciation for the versatility of assassins. Whatever the reason, he tended to wake up quickly and completely and without moving. Now he lay very still and let one hand steal slowly, slowly under his pillow. Its fingers settled around the dagger hilt, and his nostrils flared as he drew a deep, silent breath and prepared to fling himself out of the bed and away from the direction from which he thought the slight sound had come. "I do hope you're not planning to do anything hasty with that dagger, my lord," a voice said politely out of the darkness. "This is a new tunic. I'd hate to have it patched so soon." Corris froze, eyes narrowing. There was something about that voice. He couldn't quite put a finger on it, but he knew he'd heard it before somewhere. "If you don't mind, my lord," I'm going to strike a light. The voice continued as pleasantly as if it had held conversations in someone else's bedchamber in the middle of the night on a regular basis. Go ahead, the Earl invited, trying to match the voice's conversational tone. Thank you, my lord, the voice replied. There was a scratching sound, and then sudden painful light smote Corus's eyes as something flared and guttered blindingly. He smelled a stink of brimstone, and despite himself, flipped out of bed and landed in a half-crouch on its other side, dagger ready. The intruder paid him no attention. He simply lifted the glass chimney from a lamp, lit the wick, and then blew out the flaming sliver of wood he'd used to do the lighting. "What in Langhorne's name was that?" Corus demanded, his voice considerably more shaken than he would have liked. "The Corusians call it a Shanwe's candle," the other man said in an amused tone. "Personally, I think they could have come up with a more tactful name, given Vicar Zaspar's current attitude towards the Empire and the Church of Caris." He shrugged. "On the other hand, given how enthusiastically it takes fire and the stink, it is an appropriate name, don't you think? Besides, I don't think they're especially concerned by the thought of hurting the Grand Inquisitor's tender feelings these days." "Zevons," Corus said, eyes going wide as his orderly memory put a face and a name together with the oddly familiar voice. "Abraham Zevons." "At your service," Zevons acknowledged with a bow. It was clearly the same man and the same voice, but the accent and dialect had changed completely. Unlike the smuggler Corus had met earlier, this man could have stepped straight off a street, an expensive street, in Zion itself. "What are you doing here? And how the hell did you get into my bedroom?" the Earl demanded, his dagger still raised between them. "As to how I got in, let's just say King Zaim's guards aren't the most alert lot in the world. In fact, they're pretty pathetic," Zevon said in a judicious tone. "Sergeant Raymare's lads are much better than that, but there aren't very many of them, and frankly, I'm a lot better at creeping around in the shadows than anyone else they're likely to meet." "You are you?" Corus straightened from his crouch, lowering the dagger. "Given the fact that you're here, I'm inclined to take your word for that. On the other hand," his eyes narrowed, "that doesn't explain why you're here." "You sent a message to Duke Grey Harbour last month," Zevon said, his voice suddenly flat and serious, without the edge of humour which had marked it. "I'm the response." The tip of an icicle ran down Corus' spine. It was an instant, instinctive reaction, born of his awareness of just how precarious his position truly was. But he pushed the instant hollowness of his stomach aside quickly. If Zevons were an agent of the Inquisition, there'd be no point in any sort of elaborate charade designed to entrap him, and he was the man who'd delivered the messenger wyverns in the first place. "As it happened, I was in a position to get to Talkeira rather more quickly than anyone else could have done it," Zevons continued. "So Sajin Merlin asked me to deliver the reply to your message." "Merlin?" Corus repeated. He'd collected a great deal of information about Merlin Athroyes over the last 3 or 4 years. Most of it was preposterous and obviously grossly exaggerated. On the other hand, there was so much of it, he'd been forced to accept that, as ridiculous as it seemed, Athroyes truly was a Sajin. Of course, no one seemed to be exactly sure what a Sajin really was, and the old fairy tales about them didn't help a lot in that regard. So simply pinning a label on Athroyes didn't accomplish a great deal. On the other hand, the fact that this Zevons had slipped apparently effortlessly through not simply Zaim's of Delphirax's admittedly inferior guardsmen, but also past Tobis Raymare's sentries, suggested, "Should I assume you're a Sajin too, Master Zevons?" "People keep asking me that," Zevons replied with an edge of exasperation. They keep asking Merlin, too, I'm sure, and I think his response is probably the same as mine. I wouldn't call myself a Sajin, but I have to admit that Merlin and I both have some of the abilities legend ascribes to Sajins, so if you absolutely have to have a label, I guess that one's as good as any.
I see.
Corris smiled thinly, only too well aware of the surreal quality of this entire conversation. On the other hand, according to my research, very few supposed Sajins have ever called themselves Sajins during their own lifetimes.
So I've heard, Zevons agreed pleasantly. Now about that message I'm here to deliver.
By all means. Corris tossed the dagger onto the bed, where it settled into the soft mattress, then seated himself in his dressing-table chair and crossed his legs as urbanely as a man surprised in his nightshirt could manage. I'm all ears.
So I see, Sevon smiled briefly, but then his expression sobered.
First, the bad news. Duke Greyharbor is dead. Despite himself, Corris jerked upright, his mouth opening, but Zevons continued speaking. He was assassinated, along with several other members of the Imperial Council and prominent churchmen. Bishop Heinrich in Tellersberg, Archbishop Powell in Cherath, Bishop Stiwart in Chalmar. They almost got Archbishop Fairman in Erased or two, and they did kill Prince Narman.
Corris inhaled deeply, unable to hide his shock.
He'd never met any of those men, but he'd corresponded frequently with Narman, back in the days when he and Hector had been so consistently underestimating the little Emeraldian.
How in God's name?
God had very little to do with it, although that probably won't be Clintan's version. Let's just say there were several very large explosions. Explosions that killed well over 1,500 men, women, and children, in addition to the men I've just mentioned.
Zevon's expression was cold and bleak now.
The youngest victim we've identified so far was 18 months old, or would have been if she had lived another 5 days.
Langhorne! Revulsion twisted Corris' face. The man's completely mad.
I'm afraid he's just getting started, my lord, Zevon said grimly. Which is rather the point of this dramatic little visit, when you come down to it.
Yes, of course.
Corris gave himself a shake.
You say Duke Greyharbor was killed?
Obviously someone stepped into his shoes. May I ask who?
Duke Pine Hollow.
Ah, Corris nodded. An excellent choice, I think. I was always impressed by his correspondence.
My impression is that he's more than competent, Zevons replied with a slight, amused smile.
At any rate, he's read your message to Duke Greyharbor, and he's prepared to offer you, Princess Iris and Princess Davin, asylum.
Obviously, there are going to be a few strings attached.
Obviously, Corris agreed rather sourly, and Zevons chuckled.
It's only reasonable, my lord, he pointed out.
Knowing a tooth has to be pulled doesn't make the trip to the dentist enjoyable, however reasonable it may be, Corris responded, then inhaled. What would the few strings be in this instance?
First, their majesties will require you to go public, as I believe Emperor Caleb put it, about Clintan's involvement in the effort to assassinate Prince Davin and hand over any evidence you might have implicating him in Prince Hector's assassination.
He looked sharply at the Earl.
Duke Pine Hollow and their majesties are assuming that since you've seen fit to request their protection for Iris and Davin against church assassins, you've come to the conclusion they didn't have Hector murdered after all.
To be honest, Corris admitted with a sigh, I've never thought Caleb was behind that assassination. For a time I thought it might have been someone, a particularly stupid someone, trying to curry favour with him. But the more I thought about it, the more unlikely even that seemed. And I know Anvil Rock and Tartarian. There's no way they would have been party to Hector's murder, whatever the church's propagandists have said about them since they agreed to sit on Davin's Regency Council. Which only left one suspect, really, when it came down to it. He shrugged. I'm afraid, though, that I don't have any evidence he ordered Hector's assassination. I do have the orders to facilitate Davin's murder, which my valet, Robert C. Blanket, and I were sent by Archbishop Willem. They're a bit obliquely phrased, but their meaning's clear enough if you read between the lines. Of course, Reyno and Clintran are obviously going to denounce them as forgeries and us as paid liars. Of course, Zevon shrugged. On the other hand, given the way they've just assassinated over a dozen Carizians and murdered almost 200 more of them, whereas Hector is the only person Caleb's been accused of assassinating, I think you might say the preponderance of the evidence is going to be on Kari's side in the court of public opinion. It damn well is for anybody with a working brain anyway, Corris agreed grimly. Very well. I can agree to that string readily enough. And the next? Caleb and Charlian personally undertake to guarantee Iris and Davin's safety. In fact, they propose to place both of them in the personal care of Archbishop Michael. I think you know that, despite all the lies told about him by the group of four. Michael would die himself before he permitted anyone under his protection to be harmed. Corris nodded silently.